So, I figure if you guys were crazy enough to get up early, we might as well start on time out of respect and let the stragglers come in. So it appears that some people had a party last night. Actually, when I came down for breakfast, there were still people at the bar finishing up their beers. And so we thought, Clint and I just, we just thought that he told me what he was going to talk about, and I told him what I was going to talk about. We were talking about that last night, and then we came in this morning, and we both had fairly sparse groups, and it struck me that we were talking about the same thing, and why didn't we join together? That way, we have to be on our toes because we haven't rehearsed, and so we'll both learn something, but also it might be a more interesting presentation. You get two very different perspectives because our backgrounds are different. So first, I'm Bill Buxton. I work for Microsoft Research. I have shipped product. You've used products that I've had a hand in, perhaps. If you've used stuff like Sketchbook Pro on a slate, that was something. We can talk about that later. But I'm not in a product group, and I would never call myself a programmer anymore or a software engineer. On the other hand.
So I'm Clint Ruckus. You may have used some of the stuff that I've worked on, Coding for Fun Toolkit for Windows Phone. If you guys are a Windows Phone developer, it's about 30% of all applications in the store. But I am also not part of a product group at Microsoft. I am basically a 12-year-old. My job at Microsoft is to build crazy cool keynote demos. So I built things like life-size box Rock'em Sock'em robots that are Kinect drivable. I've also built t-shirt shooting robots. So nothing I build typically is product worthy. But I get to play with the new technology and learn, you know, what things will you guys have pain points on.
So, in a way, what we both do is we build fairly pushing the envelope concepts, and our practice has been to build them quickly in a way that we can test them, but a way that's sufficiently reliable that, for example, on the T-shirt things, you can put them out at the Worldwide Partners Conference in front of 60,000 people and be confident they're going to work.
Yeah.
And my stuff's the same. I can't build research prototypes and understand how the user experience works if they don't work well enough that I can give them to people to use, so I can actually see before we even go to product. So it's a question about the. So this is about process. It's about how to think about things. I was a judge. Some of you were in my category from the student side, and there's no question in my mind. I can teach. There's not a single student here that can't teach me about programming and software engineering. I've lost my chops. I'm a fellow of the Association of Computing Machinery. I have four doctorates, and I can't program as well as an undergraduate. And I'm very honest about that. I used to be reasonably good, but I've lost that. That's not what this is about. This is about, given that you can program better than me, if I could help you use those skills to better advantage, then that's something that's useful. I'm not going to teach you something I already know. So let's talk about what this is about. This first image is kind of neat. It's if we ever get to the next image, wake up, Mr. RT. Oh, this is really exciting. There we go. So I want to just talk about it. I just got out of the computer business for a while back around 2002, and decided I wanted to do something what the rest of the world did. So I did some work with a bicycle company called Trek. The guy I worked with designed every bike that Lance Armstrong ever rode in the Tour de France. And also, this is my mountain bike that he designed, which he designed for a guy named Roland Green, who won the world championship in cross country. So anyhow, there's a bike. Now, here's the question. Is there anybody in this room who could not draw a picture of that bicycle to basically give the rough idea of what the concept is of a mountain bike? I mean, everybody can draw a circle and a triangle. Everybody can draw that, right? You can draw the bike. So you sort of say, okay, well, then you have the first steps of becoming a bicycle designer. Well, it's interesting. So this is the same bike, different paint job, but it's harder to draw. But this image, if you've ever seen this Pixar film called Red's Dream, know where the bicycles John Lasseter and Bill Reeves did, and it's these bicycles all come to life at night when the bicycle store closes. If you haven't seen it, go online, find it. It's called Red Stream on the Pixar website. But this has character. It's not a distance, objective, technical drawing. This is starting to give some character. So there's something more in that bike than in your first one. The other one tells you more about the bike. This tells you more about the character of the bike. But that's not what you buy. Right? This is the important part. You don't buy those things. What you buy is this. Right? When you buy a good mountain bike, you buy the ability to scare yourself half to death, so you need to wear Pampers or diapers because it's that exciting. And yet it's, you can go so far that you won't, but you still know you won't kill yourself. And by the way, you can't even tell what kind of bike that is. By the way, it's the same bike. That's what you buy. When you buy a product, an application, whether it's a game, whether it's or a bicycle, or whether it's a spreadsheet, you are buying the experience that it engenders. You're not buying the thing. You're just giving the flux that lets the experience happen. And therefore, from the very beginning, of course you need the functionality. A bicycle has to be able to be pedaled. That's just given. But if you want to make a great product or a great application, you have to understand that's what you're designing, and the bicycle should disappear. And then the question is, if I said to draw the bicycle. The second one I said, could you draw the bicycle with the character of the bicycle. But the third thing is, could you draw the experience? And could you sketch that? And the further I go down this path, from the objective bicycle, from the object to the character of the object to the experience of using the object, it becomes harder and harder to capture in some kind of rendering. Now, if I change the word drawing to the word rendering, which means just make a representation of it no matter how, a representation that captures the most important part, it's a very different thing than drawing. But that's what we have to do. And so a lot of what we're going to talk about is how do you get quickly to something that you can experience so that you can check the fidelity of the experience and shape that rather than just making a rendering of the application that does the right quick sort or whatever the heck it is you're going to do. And so you come back to the same thing. Here's one of my older phones in my collection that you might recognize this as, I think it's a Windows 5 phone, an HTC. So again, draw the phone. Everybody can do that. Draw the phone's interface. Can you draw the interface of that phone? Can you draw the experience of using that phone? And the answer is, the further I go down here, the worse you're going to be at. Nobody in computer science school taught you to do this. How do you render the experience of using that phone? But again, what's the true object of the design? The experience is the thing you should be drawing first, not the phone. And so then we come back and say the same thing here. The experience of using this phone is completely different than the other phone. How do you shape that? And have it not just be the technology that drives the experience, but rather your design. So the whole point here is this notion of sketching. And how do you sketch? And I'm going to make this point that a sketch is different than a prototype. And a sketch is something that captures the intent of the design. What's your intention? What do you want people to feel? What do you want them to be able to do? How do you want them to experience it? What expression do you want on their face? And a drawing is just a means of realization. This is getting closer to what we'll talk about what a prototype is. And there's lots of other ways to realize a rendering besides sketching and drawing. So we're going to go this really quickly. This is Lawrence Armstrong. This is my friend Michael Sagan. This is an early sketch of Lance's time trial bike from, I think it was 2003. And there's this very clear vocabulary in how the drawing is done. You notice that the lines extend beyond the ends. If you look at this, you know this is not finished. You know this is not a blueprint. You know this is not a representation of what you should build. You know that that is not something you will give to an engineer to manufacture. You know that because of the language of the representation, how it was drawn. Nobody is going to, no manager is going to say, okay, build it. That's not what it's about. That's a character drawing, and it looks like it was done in 5 minutes. Intentionally. Even if that took 3 hours to do, it looks like it was done in 5 minutes. And that's critical. Because the minute you put more work into something, a lot of work into it, and your manager or your colleague sees you've put all this work, they are not going to say, that's a terrible idea, throw it away. It's really important that it looks like your work took no time. Otherwise, people will not be honest with you. So here's another version of the rendering. It gives more and more detail, but it's still a sketch because it still has the extended lines. This one is a computer rendering. It's looking far more technical. But you notice even here, he left the lines in because to reinforce that he's not showing the final bike, he's just trying to look at the geometry and test what the colors look like on the geometry. What does the artwork look like? This is absolutely intentional, so nobody will confuse this with a photorealistic rendering of the desired final product. And then this is getting closer, but even here on this 3D rendering, after rendering it in a 3D modeling, it's got all these lines to tell you, I'm not finished. This isn't final. What I see over and over and over again is the first thing people do when they start to do a new application is they get somebody who's trained in design, who should know better, to use Photoshop to make beautiful screenshots, beautiful renderings of the screenshots of what the menus and everything will look like at the very beginning. I would send the person who caused that to happen for retraining, re-education. Absolutely wrong. You should never have any detail that's not necessary for the purpose at hand. Otherwise, people will take it literally and start to build it. We'll talk about that. But these are the things that actually are used. And these are the sketches. These are called thumbnails, so detailed sketches for one of the most sophisticated bicycles ever built at the time. But the point here is that the visual language there is exactly what we saw in the Renaissance in the very first sketches ever used to be used in design. So here's the quick thing. This is the anatomy of sketching. Sketches have to be quick and timely. And you're going to get this with what Clint talks about. Timing is everything. You have to do it really quickly. It has to be inexpensive and disposable. You have to be able to throw it away. The minute you can't throw, if you're at the early phase of development of your concept, if you're the early phase, if you can't throw away everything you've done, you've spent too much money on it. And you're limiting your exploration. You have to have lots of them. A single sketch is useless. A single concept is useless. If you work with me, if you come in and propose an idea, and you have one idea, I won't listen to you. If you cannot generate 5 solutions to every question, where each solution is different, and you don't know which is the best, you're not a professional designer. Get somebody who is. If somebody comes in advocating a design, as opposed to saying, here's 5 options, I'm not sure which is best, these are 5 things that are all equally good, they have different properties, let's have a conversation, that's the person I'm going to hire. And that's why you need to sketch, that's why they have to be cheap. I'd rather have 5 low-resolution, quick concepts that help me explore the space early on than one beautiful rendered image. When I teach at the design schools, I take marks off for good work. If you do really good work, you fail. I kick you out of the class. You failed. Right? And the key thing is, listen, if the people looking, your managers, your colleagues, the engineers who are going to build your stuff, if they can't tell this is a tentative, speculative idea, then you failed. And you own the responsibility that they built something that you didn't want. That's your problem. You told them to build it by the way you rendered the product or the concept. And if you put anything in a sketch or a rendering that isn't absolutely required, you're wasting everybody's time and money. And you get it. If you have something where there's you've got a web page and you've made some box red, and then your colleagues come in or your managers come in or your client comes in and says, why is that red? And you say, oh, it doesn't matter. It's arbitrary. I just did that to give some character to it, but it doesn't matter. It could be blue or green. No. Why is it red? Right? The minute you made that thing red when it didn't need to be, if it didn't matter, why did you make it red? Why did you put any color at all? Because the point is that changes the conversation to the color. And if the color doesn't matter, why is it there? You have to keep the focus of the conversation. Don't put a thing in there. George Lucas, I worked with George Lucas on the Star Wars films, and I worked in films a lot. If you put a single thing in a frame of a movie that wasn't essential, no matter how much money he had, you were not going to be on the production. You don't put a single thing into a shot that doesn't serve a purpose. And if you can't tell me why it's there, take it out. The best design is not the one where there's nothing more to add. It's where you can't take anything else away without losing the concept. Why is it there? If you can't tell me, get rid of it. Until you're finally ready to start going to manufacturing. And you should never, by the rendering quality, the rendering quality says how seriously you've thought this idea through. You notice all this is in sketching font. If you want, I'll give you this font. But if I make something beautifully typeset, that means it's finished. If it's like this, I'm having a conversation. From everything, from your fonts and everything. Do not make anything high resolution. And everything is ambiguous. This is the most important thing, ambiguity. When you make your early renderings and you have your concepts, it has to be like Swiss cheese. You have to leave enough holes for the imagination to fill in the gaps. If I make a beautiful rendering of a concept, there is no room for you to add anything. Because you'll say, oh, you worked so hard in this, it's so beautiful, I can't criticize it because there's nothing I can do to improve it, and I can't make you throw it away because you worked so hard on it, you poor person. No, you incompetent boob, what are you doing thinking you're a designer? Right? There has to be room for holes, right? You have to leave room for holes for the imagination. The whole point is you make these renderings to have a conversation, and there has to be room for the conversation, and there has to be room for every single person on the team to make a contribution, because everybody has insights that can improve the thing. Otherwise, it becomes the designer in black who's the genius, and here, you poor little programmers, just program my beautiful, intelligent, great ideas. That's nonsense, and nobody should have that power. So that's the thing. I'm going to shut up now, and then we'll come back, and then Clint can jump in. The principles, though, are when you're watching, see the nature of using this term rendering, which we normally think of as drawing versus painting versus photography or sculpting like models. Think of rendering as how you render it in code. How do you render the prototype? How rough does it look? How good does it have to be? How fast can you do it? Can you do 5 different versions of everything rather than one beautiful one, which is going to be the most valuable? And here's the kicker. On what he's going to show now, the question is this. If you're working so hard to become a computer scientist, to be really, really good at programming, why would you waste your talent on not building the best product you can? Before you write a single line of code, make sure this is the thing that's worth using your hard-learned skills for. This is the thing that's worth coding. Because once you start, you won't stop. The last thing a programmer should do is program. because it's too valuable of a talent to waste. Don't just program it right, program the right thing. And so this is what this is about. So how do you do the right thing as well as do it right?
Okay. So give you a little background about me is typically I'm asked to build keynote level quality demos. So demos that cannot fail under any circumstance. And people come to me and I have basically 2 to 3 weeks to pull off a miracle. So how do we pull off these miracles? And the first one is I'm a firm believer in being a dev designer. What does that mean? Part designer, part developer. I need to be able to see what should the entire thing be, but at the same time understand how can we pull this off in that short period of time. So we need to understand both the engineering aspects of it along with how will the end user work. And we do that by brainstorming. Here is actually my my boss has one of his walls is a giant whiteboard. And when we're asked to come up with an idea, what was this for? I cannot remember what event this was for, but we were invited down to South by Southwest a couple years ago, and the theme was retro gaming. So we had to come up with a crazy project that would work with a bunch of people that were in a party environment and draw people in and make it able so that they could use the demo in about 30 seconds to a minute, but be memorable enough so that they could leave and show it off and talk about it. So the idea that we came up with at the very end was life-size Rock'em Sock'em robots. But then we have the question of, how do you get it down there? How do you ship it? How do you build it in time? What's a good experience for someone that's potentially intoxicated and driving a 700-pound robot around? And then you have a 700-pound, two 700-pound robots that are beating literally the crap out of one another every 2 minutes. And then you have a 10-mile-per-hour collision every 2 minutes as well, because each one goes about 5 miles an hour. So you have both a hardcore engineering solution, along with you have to make it so when someone looks at that, they're like, that is the coolest thing possible. Sketching. This is really funny because our slides we did not talk about in the slightest. So this was for actually a project I wanted to do, and I could not pull it off in time. A while ago, I built an automated bartender. Lots of my projects, ironically, have stuff to do with alcohol. And I wanted to shoot a shot in your mouth using Kinect. So with the Kinect SDK 1.5, you can do full tracking of someone's face. So I had a cool potential solution. Well, how do you do that? Well, I know from this sketch, you know how tall the table is. I know where your mouth is. Well, let's start doing the math. Can I do this? So this with Kinect, you were given a couple key pieces of information, but then doing research on ballistics math, I realized I wasn't getting one critical distance. So could I calculate that distance with the data I had at hand? Turns out I could. But then the problem was actually getting the liquid delivery system so you didn't get sprayed all over, and that's where it failed. So I had an engineering failure on this, but I still want to pull it off at some point.
But the key thing was, this is the case where that's going to happen in every project.
Oh, yeah.
Isn't it? Because you will never, the most important thing you design isn't the product. It's the team you need to realize the concept of the product.
Yeah. So we went, I literally tested seven different delivery mechanisms before I finally said, I will not get this done in time. We have to call an audible. Another big, big thing for me is having a tools. Not just physical tools, having tools that you know and trust and that are battle proven. So this is actually my office at work. You can see back here, because I do a lot of hardware projects, I have tons of bins. I have my favorite tools. They are my go-to. They are my magic tricks. Because I know with small bits of work, you can change something that looked this way, and you can tweak it, and now it works this way. And I know it's going to work every time. Going back to having everything I do has to be bulletproof. I'm a firm believer in thinking small and going big. So that's rather than having your solution in an entire project, like, hey, I want to add in this crazy new feature. Why develop that in the big feature or in the big product? Because the big product has a bunch of edge cases and whatnot. So this is the early prototype of the boxing robot. Like I said, we pulled this off in 3 weeks from literally deciding to do it, to building it, to soldering it. This is, I think, at about a week and a half point. So as you can see, it looks semi like a human, but we had yet to actually do connect driving. But at this point, we knew that the base could drive with an Xbox controller, and we could drive it like a first-person shooter. So now we had to do the tests of what is a good way anyone can drive this thing. So what we started doing was coming up with a bunch of different sketches on user interface, and we said, hey, if you wanted to control that, how would you control that? So stand up. How would you control it?
Boxing.
Okay. How would you make it move forward?
I would walk forward.
Okay. How would you make it turn?
I would turn.
How would you, because it drives like a first-person shooter, how would you make it strafe? First-person shooter with the thumbsticks, you can go left like this. Guess how we made it do it? Like that, for the most part. The advice we had, because it's a Kinect, and a Kinect has a certain range, we actually had to give them a bit of guidance, but literally, that's what we did. We asked multiple people, how would you do this? How would you do this? How would you do this? The answers would slightly vary, but then we start seeing trends. And then we started coding it, and then we did testing. It turns out, turning didn't work too well, because if they physically turn, you lose a skeletal track. So our advice was, keep 1 foot planted. If you want it to turn, rotate your shoulders. Okay? Because then people, it seems fairly intuitive. You want to move forward, take a step forward. You want it to box punch with its right hand, punch with its right hand. We came up with the entire, so while I was working on this part, two other coworkers were doing exactly that, going around, asking. And then now you have a bunch of independent parts that can then merge into a bigger, larger scale project. Failing. I cannot stress failing is very important. And when you fail, fail fast and fail quick and then be able to adapt. This was the bottom of a project called Jelly Bean. It was a lounge chair that was Kinect drivable. We were asked to go do a crazy demo when the Kinect SDK for Windows first came out. I learned a valuable lesson about mechanum wheels. You can actually mount them wrong. I did not realize this going back to building a project very, very quickly. So at this point, I'm like, okay, well, I got the motors, and I was more worried about it actually moving forward and backwards and not running through a wall. These wheels are mounted backwards. The treads here should actually form an O, not an X. Someone actually watched the keynote and noticed the movement was wrong on it, and literally they emailed me and said, hey, I think you have your wheels backwards. And it was something, I knew something was wrong because I couldn't, my problem was I could move forward, backwards, I could strafe, but I couldn't rotate very well. The thing wanted to dig in. And Microsoft Facilities loved me because I was pulling up the tiles on the floor in the hallway. But as soon as that guy said that, I literally, the next day, in the area, flipped it over. And note, this weighs about 500 pounds. Had a guy help rip off the wheels and put them on correctly. Because the entire design of that is to be able to alter it and change it very, very quickly. If you guys are mechanical, extruded aluminum is your best friend. It's cheap, has rivets or guide rails. You can pop stuff in, pop it out, and it just makes life so much easier.
So this thing about failing is really important.
And this is why you have to things have to be cheap. And you know, the standard old line you've probably heard a million times is fail early and fail often. But it isn't just for things like this. The whole point about sketching and early phase development is to fail as soon as possible, because if you have to start again, you've spent the least amount of money and the least amount of time. So in the last 10 years, who's one of the most successful people in the computer industry? Not in Microsoft.
Steve Jobs.
Okay. Who was the biggest failure I've ever met in my life?
Steve Jobs.
So I knew Steve. He was the biggest failure. It's unbelievable, his failures. Think about it. He got kicked out of Apple, right? He did the G4 Mac, for example. It was a disaster, this beautiful square thing. On the Bondo Blue iMac, they did the circular, what in Canada we call a hockey puck mouse. This mouse that when you move it this way, the cursor could go any way. It was a complete disaster. He had disaster after disaster after disaster. And here's the point. If he hadn't have had those failures, he would never have had the success. People never remember your failures if they're the right kind of failure. The right kind of failure isn't a failure. It's an education with a very high tuition fee that the only question that remains once you've had it is, did you learn anything, and will you apply what you learned in the next thing you do? If people work with me, including myself, because I'll fire myself, I don't fire anybody, I'm just speaking metaphorically. If you always are getting things right and you never fail, you're not trying hard enough. You're not pushing hard enough. You're not going close enough to the edge. The whole point is to learn how to fail and managing the failure. That's what this is about. And then making sure, because when you fail, other people are around, if you have designed your team properly, so they'll give you the feedback and make sure your process lets you adjust.
Let me just first say, he has not seen my slides, and this is going to be hilarious. So next big one is never say quit. I will stay up and literally, we were 15 hours over the time to get the, so this was for, we built a car with a TV show called Inside West Coast Customs. We had 72 hours of integration time to get all our tech in it and tested. So that meant dealing with multiple different power supply levels from DC to AC, back to DC, et cetera, et cetera. We were 15 hours over the time limit to ship the car back to Seattle. And then when the car got to Seattle, the unveiling, it got to the mall at midnight. Guess what time I fell asleep then the next day? About midnight the next day. Me and a couple coworkers stayed overnight in a mall battle testing to prove that that car could work over and over and over again, because little things weren't working. Like an example for us would be in the car, we had custom car horns. So you could go through and, like, me personally, I like Knight Rider or the A-Team. So you hit the horn and play the A-Team theme song. The problem we ran into was a car's horn is a reverse switch, so it's always on, and you press it, and then it decouples it. The issue was when the laptop we had was plugged in, it grounded the signal. And then that, through the USB, would literally cause the car horn to always go off. So you plug in the laptop to give it power, the car horn would go off. When we were testing this in the car before, our laptops weren't plugged in. It wasn't until the very end did we realize, oh crap, we have a really critical bug in one of our showcase features. So how do you guys think we actually solved that? Any guesses? You guys know what a relay switch is? Who knows what a relay is? So we literally put a relay in between the two objects, so then we basically isolated the power supply. So then we could toggle the switch with the relay while the laptop was plugged in, and that was independent to the horn. So now we could say, hey, relay switch, click, and then the horn would go off, tell it to, you know, disengage, it would flip back. It was an interesting hack, but it was a hack that we pulled off in about an hour after we figured out exactly what the problem was. We literally spent, had to be 2 to 3 hours just trying, seeing like, hey, what happens if we remove the shielding on the USB cord? Is something wrong with the computer? How many computers did we try? I think we tried like 4 different computers to verify, was it the power supply? Was there something wrong with the power? What was going on? But like I said, we literally were shipping so hot that we spent the night in the right before the unveil in the mall. Next thing, and this is actually the car, is being realistic. You know, is this possible? A lot of the features that were being thrown around, once you start diving into them, we're like, not really that good of an idea on the time frame we had. The team that built this was 3 people, plus the guys at West Coast to do the actual mechanical fabrication. 3 guys pulled off a ton of tech. The car could actually detect your skeleton, lock, unlock. There was a full-blown phone app. The rear glass would roll up, and you'd have the world's craziest entertainment system. Everything, including the kitchen sink, was in here. Next one is friends. Always have people you can throw ideas around. So this is, if you guys watched This Week on Channel 9, that's Brian Keller, and that's actually my boss, and they're best friends, and this was a joke that Brian pulled on Dan, just putting his picture up there to verify Dan was not goofing off. This is my boss. We're, you know, I would say, did I just hit something? No, I didn't. Best friends. This is Brian Peek. He's one of my closest friends at work. This guy, if you've used the Kinect for Windows SDK, this guy is freaking a genius when it comes to low-level code. I can throw ideas past him, and he'll be like, well, this is going to have this implication. If you do this, this is going to have this kind of implication. Going back to Brian Keller, this guy, if I have any questions that are related to Visual Studio, chances are he knows the answer or knows who to talk to get me that answer that I need. Duncan McKenzie, this guy's a wizard at Azure. He actually put, Channel 9 is basically kind of like YouTube. We encode any video in about 15 different formats. And so think of it kind of like YouTube. He built a system called Magic Folder, which does all this video encoding, and then he put it in Azure. We had a product team at Microsoft that then said, hey, you know what we're going to build? We're going to build basically your system without knowing that we had already done it. So now we can encode videos on the fly, and if like 10 different people are having videos encoded, that system scales up. This guy's freaking really, really smart, and I just love throwing ideas past him as well. But also I have non-technical friends. This is Dr. Randy Guthrie. He's an academic evangelist. This is he was my mentor when I first started. He helped pull me above the waterline, teach me the ropes. He actually taught me basically how to handle email. I know Bill is probably, you're a Microsoft veteran, so you know roughly how much email we get. It's a decent sum, and it's how to triage that stuff. I used to be, you know, a straight-up developer, and I wasn't used to getting hundreds of pieces of email a day and how to deal with it. Same thing with Golnaz. Golnaz is here filming you guys for Channel 9. She is not technical, once again, but she provides that different view on things. So going back to interfaces, she's one of the people we throw ideas past because she thinks differently than engineers. We think of the engineering solution first and then the interface second. I'm a firm believer you think of the interface first, let people play with it, do rapid prototyping. Going back to that piece of paper and then seeing what they do. And then just don't take yourself too seriously. I know I'm not the smartest guy in the room. I mean, that's my, this Jeff Sanquist is my skip boss. This is one of my good friends, Nick Fillingham. He's dressed as a cloud for an internal video. Don't take yourself seriously because there's always going to be someone smarter than you and your idea may not be the best idea in the world, but And if you guys always have that I'm the smartest person in the world feel, no one's going to want to work with you. Be humble.
So the more important your project is, the more important what he just said is. There's a line from Oscar Wilde that I'll slightly distort. These things are far too important to take seriously. Right? You'd sort of think serious things should be taken seriously. There's a reason we joke around. There's a reason we take what we're doing today. Just, we don't know each other that well. But we know each other by reputation and what we do. You take the risk. But the main point is you have to have fun at it. And this is really incredible. Think about it. If you're so nervous that this is so important that it's just going to, everything's going to go like that, how can you be creative? How can you do that? How can you sit around and pop ideas up if you're so tense because, oh my God, we're under so much pressure? It doesn't mean you're fooling around being the class clown. But the funny thing is that when you say something absurd, come to work dressed as a clown or a cloud. So I'll give you an example, because I love that example. Okay? So Richard Harper, he's one of the world's top sociologists. He's a manager at Microsoft Research in Cambridge, England. I was working in a lab. We were looking at stuff, technology for the home. He had to give a major presentation at the laboratory. This is Microsoft Research, Cambridge, England. England. He's a proper English person with a proper English accent. He wears a jacket and a tie to work, for pity's sakes. Nobody does that at Microsoft. He does.
That's when you're interviewing.
No. He's a manager. He doesn't have to interview. He's got a job. I said, Richard, come to work tomorrow in your pajamas and give your talk in pajamas. He didn't ask me why. He didn't do anything. He just said, okay. And he did. He sort of say, so here's this PhD in sociology in front of all these people doing this important presentation. He's in his house coat and pajamas. And at a certain point, people had to ask, why are you in your pajamas? And the point was, it would be perfectly acceptable if he was working at home and coming in a teleconference to attend that meeting wearing his pajamas. But the clothing that's appropriate for home is not appropriate for Microsoft Research at the work. So why would you expect the same computer that's appropriate at work to be appropriate at home? Right? Why is it different about the technology than it is about your clothing? So why would you expect home things, what's appropriate for the office to be appropriate at home in computers, if what's appropriate at home isn't appropriate at the office in terms of clothing and other things? Why is it different? And it's just to provoke that thought, and wearing something like that, just playing around, gets that point across in a way that nobody will forget. Everybody remembers when Richard went to work in his pajamas.
So another slide that I don't actually have, but I want to stress, is always be shipping. If you don't ship, no, you've never actually made a full product. I cannot stress that enough. And the reason why is, like, this is an example. I built this 7-8 years ago, a computer-controlled disco dance floor. And this is actually the project that got me hired on to Microsoft. The most absurd project you can think of is what landed me at Microsoft. Because when I lived in Chicago, I would always I'd throw these big house parties, and I had this semi-flawed theory of girls like to dance. If I have a dance floor in my apartment, I'll meet more girls. Which some of you guys are like, hey, that's actually pretty smart. So I built a computer-controlled disco dance floor. And when I'm building it, I wanted to learn a couple core tenets. So I had my, this is what I want to do, but at the same time, I wanted to learn some crazy things about threading along with hardware. This was my first hardware project that I really worked on. And it could do crazy things. It was like 14 feet by 8 feet, I think a total of 650 LEDs that were RGB compliant. And I'm shocked my roommate didn't kill me. It could do things like, let's see if this actually plays. So it did animations, it could read animated GIFs, it could play different animations. It was a total of 8 different hardware boards that all had to interact at the same time. So it's how do you tell that board how to flash or to update itself? And you have to do that roughly at 33 times every second to get a smooth animation. I've never did this before, and I was just like, eh, why not? Let's try it. What's the worst case that could happen? Get hired by Microsoft? And then going back to that, then I started getting yelled at for making drinks too strong. So as an engineer, I said, hey, you know what I could do? I build an automated bartender. So I actually took the solution of, hey, I'll give you an RFID card, and you tell the computer how to make it, what drink you want, and it'll pour the same drink over and over and over again at the exact same proportion. And it could do things like track exactly how much you drank, and for certain friends, it would actually switch from the high-end vodka to the low-end vodka. I actually showed it off at PDC a couple years ago, and this project actually blew up one of my laptops because I had a wiring mistake, and it actually sent AC through the USB port into my computer, and I saw the magic blue smoke come out of my keyboard, and my friend who was there helping me out literally looked at me. His response was, we're going to the bar right now, aren't we? And that was the only thing that was ever said about that. Going back to learning, this is the t-shirt shooting robot. This was my first kind of large-scale project at Microsoft, pulling off a very, very crazy project in a very short period of time. We built two of these in 2 weeks. When I was asked to do this, I had a corporate vice president send me an email, and in that email I had literally all the entire management chain up to his corporate equivalent in my org, and I got this at 8 p.m., and I'm like, I am so not responding to this email. Fast forward a couple hours, and many, many emails without that corporate vice president on it. It said, hey, Clint's going to do this. At no point did anyone ask me, could I even buy the parts and get them to me in time? So literally it was, okay, how do we pull this off? What parts do we need, et cetera, et cetera. So we actually used a BattleBot chassis for this and started working on it. It looks kind of rough because we had only a couple days to put it together and ship it out. I spent more on shipping the parts than I probably did on the physical robots. This is the keynote stage. We literally took over an entire conference room trying to get these things together. I learned so much about how to properly do battery charging based on this project. I made the mistake of, at this project, I had to physically remove this entire top to charge the batteries. That was a dumb mistake on my part, because then it meant I had to readjust everything, put it back in, verify all the wires were connected, and there was a couple times where those wires didn't connect, and they caused I actually had an electrical fire in my office once based on that. It was just a fun project. Now you'll note, going to parts, you'll see this same motor controller on a lot of my projects. You'll see a couple of these boards on these projects. This project actually has I built a custom wiring board to help my power distribution from the automated bartender. So I'm like, hey, how do I do wiring to multiple different switches? Oh, hey, I already built that part. Why not just reuse it? Technically, it wasn't for that same project, but it's like, hey, it works. It gets the job done. So actually, that part is this. All I have to do is put in power there, and all these get power then. And all I have to do is plug it into a relay switch, and it works. It's magic. It's awesome. This is the Project Jelly Bean. So this is a lounge chair. That's Scott Guthrie, if you guys know. Once again, that's a corporate vice president at Microsoft not taking himself seriously. His entire response when he saw that was, how do I ride that? So we came up with the idea, and very, very quickly we came up with sketches. We started throwing the sketch ideas, and along with the interface. How do we pull this off? You know, if the wheels are 10 inches, how fast will this go? Do we opt for on the motors? Do we opt for power or speed? Actually, I'll ask you guys. Okay, I have one. I can buy parts basically once, typically on these projects, because of the time it brings it. Would you opt for power for the motors or speed on the motors? Who says speed? Two people. Who says power? Why do you opt for power and torque? Pardon? Let's say the motors would literally weigh the same. The reason why you opt for torque is you can gear it down and make the torquier motors faster. If you have, it's easier to do that than it is to gear them up to get more torque. So after doing the math with the more torquey motors, it was still going at about 5 miles an hour, and it could literally drive itself through a wall. To me, that's awesome. Here it is, uncovered, shipped. You can see all the crazy wiring. People actually enjoyed the wiring more. So the base here, because of the wheels, you have a dilemma of they shake. The Mecanum wheels shake. So if you have all your wires are crimped, what's the fear that could happen? The wire could shake loose. And as you can see, I have 8 lead acid 12-volt 17-amp-hour batteries that are wired in 24 volts. That is a lot of power and potential fire hazard. Going back to causing yet another fire in my office, I caused the fire in my office with 2 of these batteries wired together. It goes up quick. So what I did was every joint, every solder, every crimp point was also hand soldered to verify that cord would not come loose. Going back to having everything being battle proof. Testing small. This is just verifying that the lounge chair, you know, we could do a hand gesture and the chair would recline. You do that hand gesture again, it would come back up. But do you test that when everything is built and it's on the chassis, or can you test that small? It's an independent feature. So we started testing that small. You can see Visual Studio in there. All I did was build a little WinForm or WPF app, click a button. Does that code work? Click the button again. Does it go back? And each one of these like independent objects was in a test app. So I could literally go in and test each core functionality here independently.
So here's a really interesting thing to try and tie some what I was saying. So he's getting into prototyping there. So if you're trying to test the gestures for the chair and test the chair to come up and down, what's the fastest way to make that work? Because you remember we said always be shipping? The other way of saying that is always be finished. And the question is just how refined is the thing that's finished? If Disney makes a cartoon, the movie's finished before it starts. It's just a boring movie because it's all black. You get 90 minutes of blank film, and that's the movie. And then they'll start cutting into that, sketches, storyboards, and they'll just keep replacing and replacing and replacing. But there's always, if it's going to be a 97-minute movie, they've got, from the very first day, they have a 97-minute movie. So that chair was finished. You could have had it working completely, gesture recognition, everything working from the very first day. How? Without writing a line of code, without building a piece of hardware. How? Yeah. No, it has to be physical. You have to experience. I have to be able to put you on the chair and have the chair respond to your gestures. How would you do that?
Puppeteer.
You hire people to do it. You do Wizard of Oz. It's just like the Wizard of Oz. You have the person in the chair, they do the gesture, and somebody's sitting behind lifting the chair up physically. And every time they make a gesture, they follow the rules exactly. And they put it up and down, and you find out whether the gestures are stupid or not, because can they do it while it's going up and down? Can they control it? And you just have people pushing it around. You find a way through theater so that you can actually experience it. And then you can explore, is this a sensible gesture? Can we do it a better way? And that's the point, is that right from the very beginning, the project was finished. It's just what was the refinement? And the one other thing about this that's really important is that you notice that a lot of the examples I gave, and these examples, are all involving hardware. How many of you actually build hardware? Okay, that's more than I would have expected. That's good. So a lot of you are doing software. So say, well, how is this relevant to software? Well, first of all, it's just easier to draw images to you know, it's easier to have examples that are far away from what you're doing so you can get the concept. I want you to learn the concept, then map it onto what you do in software. That's one answer. But the other answer is we're moving into the space of the Internet of Things, of this, what I call the society of devices, this whole thing around ubiquitous computing. Personally, I cannot see. Here's what I would say. If you can see where software ends and hardware begins, it's almost certainly a failure of design. Where, on an iPod, the original iPod with the scroll wheel, where does the user interface, the hardware end and the software begin in terms of the user experience there? Which, by the way, wasn't a good experience. It was a bad design. But the point is this. It should be seamless between hardware and software. In the 70s, when I started to design stuff, you had to do hardware and software. After about 1984, 85, user interface design became just software. You just took the graphic user interface for granted, the mouse, keyboard, CRT, or LCD, and then you worked. Today, you must do hardware again. And you have to make the hardware work together with each other. It's way more important today to make devices that cooperate when they come close together than it is to make any single application or any single device. Those days are going to be over. They're already over, we just don't know it yet. And so, A, hardware teaches us how to approach software. But second, if you think about hardware and software as separate things, you are going to probably, in this world of interactive appliances and gadgets, in the Internet of Things, in the society of devices, you're probably going to get it wrong. So there's two messages here that I think are really important. Even in these things, you saw the paper renderings, but you can start building these experiences even sooner.
And going back to yet another rendering. So this was boxing robots. So boxing robots had a key advantage. So you saw the Project Jelly Bean, the lounge chair project, boxing robots were like, how do we do this and do it cool, safe, et cetera, et cetera? And then we were like, hey, we already have a base that can work and do first-person shooting, basically. So we literally ripped off the lounge chair. I built a quick interface that could use with the Xbox controller, and we did puppeteering and to verify, did that interface work while someone else was building out the rest of the stuff. So, like, my big thing was I had to shave off about a foot and a half of the length of that of the lounge chair. So it was like, okay, crap, how do you fit in all the same gear in something that's about this big and fit into about this big? So someone else was worrying about that. I had to start putting back on my engineering hat and doing that and verifying things like, can I fit in the motors? Can I fit in the wheels? What things don't I know, and can I start thinking 3D, putting in motor controllers, mounting them sideways? Do they work sideways, et cetera, et cetera?
So I noticed the word in there,
10 o'clock. Oh, oops. Sorry. Okay. Looks like...
let me just check one thing here.
You want to switch to you?
Oh, maybe.
So the big thing while Bill is trying to find the slide is think about all the cool things that your end users can use and do with your applications. They are, to me, like the number one thing. Going back to devices, how are they going to interact with it? Do they realize that the device is there? How many people here have a Kinect? How many people have an Xbox with the Kinect, I should actually say? Okay, so the cool thing with Kinect, with Xbox, is you can literally go Xbox, start Netflix. And my girlfriend, when she saw me do that, her mind was blown. And then now, I have the dilemma of, I'll be at my apartment, she'll start being like, I'll play a game. She's like, no, you're not, basically. And then she'll grab a controller and start playing Netflix on me, or being like, pausing to get the movie when I don't want her to. But because now she knows, like, she can do all these commands, she's not technical, but she can do this now because she saw how easy it is.
So, my office is just on the same floor where
sort of all the people and directors of the research lab are, and so on and so forth. And so it's more administration. So what my office looks like his. I have boxes with X-Acto knives, foam core, glue guns, all kinds of tape and other stuff so I can mock things together really quickly. I purposely go out in the hallway and do it in the hallway. The director of the lab walks by and says, Bill, we have a laboratory workshop down on the main floor. Why are you wrecking our rugs and making a mess in our hallway? Everything's perfect. I said, that's exactly right. It's too perfect. It's too clean. It's too tidy. This is a research lab. Get over it. He's my boss, but who cares?
Let me just say that Microsoft Research Lab, I'm so happy you guys have given me access to that.
Yeah. So we have good tools, but I had a student. So this is what an undergraduate student did. So this is back in 2005. So this is before everybody discovered that wrist computers might be interesting. There's a whole other story about that if you want. I'm happy to talk to you about, but we not now. But the question was, how do you work if you want to use touch on a small screen like that, where your fingers represents 25% or more of the surface of the display? You're going to cover it up. So he came up with a pretty clever idea. And so this is a software concept. And of course, oh, piece of crap. Yes. There.
Let's see if I can actually get this.
Oh, you're a genius. So he came up with this idea. So he basically got foam core. He drew a picture of a hand. He drew a picture of the watch. He cut a hole in the foam core. You see, one side's the top of the hand, the other side's the bottom. In between, he put this strip with the screens. He puts the strip between those and closes it like a sandwich, okay? So now he has that. So there is your device. You see the watch on his hand, and there's the cursor. I'm not saying this is a good idea. I'm saying this is a really interesting technique. If you don't have this technique in your repertoire, look at there's a workbook that I'll tell you about if you want, where you can start every Friday, spend half a day. So the point here is there's the cursor. The piece of paper is sort of underneath. And so when you move the cursor and so on, the screen changes. It's interactive because you pull the piece of paper underneath the hole because it's guided like a film strip. And you sort of say, well, how do you move the cursor? And what you do is the cursor has a magnet on the bottom of it. And on the bottom side, he has just a map pin. So he moves, he's holding the thing like this. There's the picture of the wrist. There's the picture of the watch. And he wanted to find out, what if I make this part of the watch a touch surface? So could I control the cursor and pointing by doing this from the bottom rather than the top? Just do it on the other side. And so how well would that work? So he made a working prototype by two pieces of foam core, drawing a picture of the hand, cutting the holes so that you just have the thin piece of paper slipped in. See, watch, I can prototype this right.
And the cool thing here is, how quickly can this guy change his interface now?
Yeah, so right?
How much code does he have to change?
So here we go. There's the hole. There's the hand. There's the bottom of the hand. Okay, there's the bottom, there's the top, there's the hole.
And what he's doing right now, this kind of back and forth, this happens in the office. And now, boom, you have a working prototype. And how easy is it now that you see that item, to visualize what's going on?
Okay, so there's the hand like so, and so I move in the hole here, I move the mouse, the cursor goes, and so I go to the second screen. There it goes. Then you go to the third screen, right? So you can actually test, here's what it might look like, that's the animation, just like that. Two pieces of paper, and so on. That's how fast you have to do this. And then,
you want to go to the movie?
Yeah, let's go to the movie. Okay. And then,
And so, of course, it's awkward in the transitions. So that's why God made video cameras. And, you know, you've got your webcam. So then all he does is we shoot the video, somebody pulls the thing through, then the next thing, and then you edit the video and you take out the transitions. So here, watch this thing work. This takes half an hour to build a working prototype of this interface. Oh, give me everything. Is it going to work?
This also pays when you have a small armada of devices.
So, you know, I said hardware is important. So I travel with multiple devices, computers. I test what I can, but my view is if somebody's going to get screwed by technology, it should be me, not my customer.
So at Microsoft, we have this thing called dog food. This is dog fooding in real life.
Yeah. But this is what you do. You just have to make it work. But the point is that we could have shot this and done this on the fly, but we don't have time. But this is the type of thing you have to be comfortable, and you have to practice. It's like if you're a piano player. It doesn't matter if you were a really good piano player. Okay, here he is. He's showing it working from below. And there's what you see. There's the cursor moving. Notice the cursor even follows. The arrow, it spins and has the proper thing. How long would it take you to write code to do this compared to what I just did with paper? And now he's got the icons. He comes here. He's going to come down. What's he going to select? Oh, he's going to go to the mail. Bang. Click. Bang. See it? It works. And let's see. He's going to get a send receive. You just pull a piece of paper underneath while the video camera's running, and then you take the video and you just cut out the part where you're pulling the paper across. And if you had a blend or a flip, you could animate the interface. You could control the transitions. But is this software or hardware? See, it's even got a percent done progress bar. Right?
No app is complete without a progress bar.
And I'm not saying this is a good idea. This isn't a good design. But you find out whether it's a worthwhile design right from the very beginning. And so there's a spectrum. And there's all kinds of techniques, but if we work on things like that before we start to code and start to build. But the other part that you saw from Clint is he's recycling things. The more you build, the better you get at it. You build these modules, and what he described there with the motors and the power supply and so on and so forth, these different modules, is exactly what happens in object-oriented programming, where you have different objects that you recycle. You don't write code. You basically clone code and just reconfigure it as you build up these components. And it's exactly the same notion. So I guess the last thing I can say, and if you want, I don't know what's in this room next.
It starts right now.
We've got to shut up. Okay. If you go to my website, there's two books. Don't buy if you're only going to get one, get the cheap one, which is the workbook. And it just gives you a whole bunch of exercises that you can work with your group and just go through these exercises. It's a really inexpensive book. I get no royalties from it, so I'm comfortable just telling you about it. And it's just called Sketching User Experiences, the Workbook. And that'll help you get some techniques. And thank you very much for your time. There you go.
Thank you, sir.